Session number 13143.
It's Pond Reel 5.
And so it was a very interesting job. I had to make my own job because I had no immediate boss. I had a Jeep, and I was my own driver. I had a secretary and a small office in Hanover. And I went all over the Rhine Army area, visiting all the battalions, the infantry, the tanks, the artillery, mainly at that time writing stories for local newspapers saying what local boys were doing. And I covered them on manoeuvres, I covered them in sports activities like skiing and sports and sailing and so on. That's when I discovered that the yachts that we had acquired at the end of the war had finished up in a Rhine Army yacht pool and had never been delivered to Southampton at all. Anyway, that went on for a while, and then my boss from the War Office rang and said, would I like to go to Korea? And I said, yes, that would be suit me down to the grounds. I liked the idea very much indeed. So
why? Why were you so keen on it?
Well, peacetime soldiering in Germany wasn't exactly the most exciting thing in the world to do. I'd become a regular officer for the sake of seeing the world and getting lots of adventure and fun. So that was the reason I was very keen to do it. The other advantage that I soon discovered was, again, in Korea, I did nominally have another boss, but he used to leave me alone to run my own affairs. So I flew from London, Heathrow, which in those days was a whole series of sort of corrugated iron huts, and we went in a converted York bomber, which had been converted for civilian use. And I seem to remember it took us about 2 weeks to get to Tokyo, because the engine broke down so often that we had to wait for spares to be flown out and so on. And I flew from Tokyo into Seoul, where I met up with the British Commonwealth Division, division which had, in addition to British, it had Australian, New Zealand, Indian, and people from all over the Commonwealth, and eventually became a very, very good division. It took over from the independent brigades that had seen all the big, big fighting up on the Imjin River. This was, as I say, must be 1950 or something. And by this time, the Allies were on the 38th parallel, just facing the Koreans, the North Koreans and the Chinese. And again, it was a trench warfare, interspersed with patrols, shelling attacks, but no real movement on the part of either side.
And what rank did you have then?
I was a major at this time, attached to divisional headquarters. And again, my job there really was writing local boys' stories and getting... I had a photographer and a tape wire recorder actually there, and also a teleprinter, a radio teleprinter, to send stories back. And at that time, the BBC asked Army Public Relations if they could do some work for them. This is why I had the wire recorder, and I used to do various reports for the BBC, which they used to broadcast from time to time. And I was also in charge of the press camp at divisional headquarters, where we had correspondents from all over the world. And the job there really involved giving them a daily briefing on what was going on, taking them up to the front line if necessary, helping them in every possible way I could. And we had correspondents from virtually every part of the world there coming in. And then they came to an armistice, and they opened up an armistice camp at Panmunjom, which still exists today. And I used to go in there and take people backwards and forwards. And virtually the last job I did there was when the prisoners of war, the Commonwealth prisoners of war, started coming back. I helped debrief them and then helped them at press conference, when we sort of put them in front of the reporters to tell their tales of what happened while they were prisoners in China. Most of them had been vaguely brainwashed and so on, but I think most of them soon recovered from it. They were fairly resilient chaps.
What can you tell me, one or two of the most interesting stories that you handled whilst you were in Korea?
Well, I think the peace talks were very interesting, as were the return of the troops. But mainly we had, I'd go up and debrief people who'd fought in no man's land during the night. People like the Royal Norfolk Regiment were there, the Black Watch were there, I can remember patrols. And the weather was, in winter there, was really awful. And there were many occasions when sentries froze to death because it was so cold. And even though all people on night patrols and sentries were issued with hand warmers, which were sort of petrol burners in cases, the Japanese they were, and these would be put by their feet, in their trousers, on their hands. And yet, even with things like this, you'd get 35, 40 below with vicious winds to go with it. It was really unbelievably awful. So that was very tough for the troops in the front line. Of course, we were dominated by the Americans. Most of the facilities were supplied by Americans. We had American rations, very much American transport, American funeral services. Remember there was a what they called not a funeral train, but something like that. You used to come up to the front every day to take the dead back in, and people used to go and scrounge ice from this train so they could have ice with their drinks. It was rather a macabre sign of what happened. It was interesting to see how the different Commonwealth troops knitted together, and altogether it wasn't that easy. A lot of the Commonwealth people were, I think, were quite resentful of the British in a way, and they preferred to stay with their own kind and this sort of thing. I remember once travelling with the divisional commander, who at that time was General Jim Castles, who was a very, very nice super general, a really general of the soldiers, marvellous chap. And we were travelling on a back road going to see some Australians. We were going up a little hummock, like a hump bridge, and at the top we met an Australian jeep, more or less bonnet to bonnet, and a great big Australian stood up and said, "Fuck off!" And the general, who'd been driving without his hat on, sort of looked and he thought, So he put his red hat on, stood up in the jeep and said, "Fuck off yourself!" Whereupon the Australian said, "Fair enough, mate!" They backed off and went away. I tell you that because it was a sign of what sort of chap this general was. He really was a very much down-to-earth chap, and he needed to be, dealing with people like Aussies and French Canadians. They really were tearaways. They didn't really know much about discipline, but they were very good fighters.
Why should there have been resentment of the British?
I think the days of the old colonial days were coming to an end, and there was still a fair number of people around, you know, who would talk about colonials and tend to look down their noses at them and so on. It wasn't anything very strong, but I think they all felt the end of the war is in sight and we're our own people now, and we're going to go and do our own things. There was a very good spirit, in fact, but they weren't going to take any old British nonsense about colonial boys and this sort of thing. The Indians were very good there. They ran the field ambulance hospital there, and they were absolutely excellent, particularly for Sunday curries, I remember. They used to throw out a big invitation for everybody. The American evacuation helicopters were absolutely superb. And you'd get a wounded chap, and behind every battalion there was a helicopter landing pad, and the helicopters would fly in below the hills, land, put the wounded on board, and off they'd go. It was a very sophisticated war as far as we were concerned, because the Americans had so many good things, and the American rations were outstanding.
The American troops themselves as fighters got something of a poor reputation in Korea. Did you think that was deserved from what you saw of them?
On our left flank was the Marine Division, and they were probably some of the bravest troops I've ever seen. They were also supported by their own aircraft. The only thing you could say about the Marines was that they were foolhardy, because they would keep doing the same thing time and again, although the Chinese were shelling them and giving them a hard, hard time. But nobody could accuse the American Marines of being less than courageous, because they were really tremendous. I had no experience of other fronts. We heard that the South Korean battalions weren't too good, but again, that was only hearsay. The French had a battalion there. I used to go and see them, but never in action. They were very good because in return for our rations of whiskey and gin, they would give us gallons and gallons of semi-dehydrated wine, which we would take back to our own units and top up, get back to the correct proportions and enjoy ourselves.
What did people think of the enemy, the Chinese enemy?
Again, I think we didn't really understand what was going on. I remember one crazy thing, the Queen's coronation, or was it the, would it be the coronation or the...
The coronation was summer 1953.
Right.
But she acceded to the throne in February 1952.
Yeah, but it must have been summer 1953, because believe it or not, the artillery of the Commonwealth Brigade on the day of the coronation fired red, white and blue smoke at the Chinese, who must have been very nonplussed, wondering what the hell was going on. And I remember too, we had a parade in honour of the coronation behind the Commonwealth Division, and President Sigmund Rhee came up with his German-born wife to this parade, and we had American units, and all the Commonwealth units were represented there. And I was with General Jim Castles, and walking along with President Rhee, and President Rhee didn't speak very good English, kept saying, "Queen Lilibet, very fine man. Queen Lilibet, very fine man." And I remember the general could hardly prevent from laughing all the time. And his German wife, who again didn't speak too much English, was trying to correct him in broken German. But it all worked out very well. The pipes of the Black Watch paid and played, and somebody beat the retreat, and it was all really moving and very good. But as I say, from the Chinese point of view, they must have wondered what red, white and blue smoke was about.
Trying to correct him in broken German?
Yes, well, she was German. Well, it wouldn't be broken German, it would be broken English or Korean, presumably.
Was there any sense at all of the politics of the Korean War amongst the people who were there?
Not in the army level, no.
So it wasn't regarded as a crusade against communism?
Not really. The army don't think that way. It's only subsequently when they retire that the old generals give off. They don't normally express any views while serving.
Just a job.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we had visitors like, I think, Field Marshal Alexander was defense minister or something at the time. He came out. All sorts of people used to come out and visit. I remember Lady Reading came out for the WVS because they had some WVS out there. And I remember she gave a press conference. And somebody, an American, said, "Gee, what did you do during the war, Lady Reading, during the big war?" And she said, "Oh, I was abroad." And, of course, the Americans didn't understand this at all. They totally misunderstood it. Lady Mountbatten came out, and I remember she was travelling in a jeep with the general, and I was in the back probably with a photographer or something, and we crossed a bridge over the Imjin River, and the river was alive with soldiers bathing, and they were all in the nude. But they were all very bronzed because they'd been digging trenches and working in the sun. And I remember Lady Mountbatten saying, "Oh, they all wear white to trunks." Whether she was kidding us or not, I don't know. But
How did you get the mention in dispatches whilst you were in Korea?
Oh, I think it was for the work I'd done in connection with sending news back to London, news that was used by national newspapers and by the BBC. I think that's what it was. They never tell you what you get these things for.